I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Thank you for joining us today for the American Idea podcast. I am Kara Rogers Stevens, Associate Professor of History at Ashland University. Today, we are honored with not one, but two fantastic guests. First of all, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the show Dr. John White, Professor of American Studies at Christopher Newport University. John is the author or editor of 19 books and more than 100 different articles, essays, and reviews about Abraham Lincoln, the Civil War, slavery and emancipation, and the U.S. Constitution. Frankly, I'm exhausted just reading that sentence. I'm very intrigued to know, John, how in the world you found the time to do so many different publications. Very impressive. His book, A House Built by Slaves, African-American Visitors to the Lincoln White House, was a co-winner of the 2023 Gilder Lehrman Lincoln Prize. He's also the editor of A Great and Good Man, Rare Firsthand Accounts and Observations of Abraham Lincoln. And our second guest is Dr. Lucas Morell, professor of politics at Washington and Lee University. Professor Morell is a trustee of the Supreme Court Historical Society, a former president of the Abraham Lincoln Institute. And I'm most intrigued by his current job, which is serving on the U.S. Commission to Plan Activities commemorating the 250th anniversary of the founding of the United States of America. Lucas, maybe you can give us some hints as to what sort of activities might be in our future for that.
All right.
He has written such works as Lincoln and the American Founding and Lincoln's Sacred Effort, Defining Religion's Role in American Self-Government, among many other works. Lucas and John are here today to discuss their new book. It's called Measuring the Man, The Writings of Frederick Douglass on Abraham Lincoln. It comes out on October the 1st. So let me start by asking you, gentlemen, how did this book come about? Who had the idea? How long have you been working on it? And what is it?
Yeah, so I'll start. And I had the idea a little while ago to do a short reader of sort of the main highlights of everything that Frederick Douglass said about Abraham Lincoln during Lincoln's presidency. And my initial thought was actually, I teach a lot of Lincoln and I teach a lot of Frederick Douglass in my classes. So I wanted a primary source book that would be very short, concise, that I could use for those purposes. And I think it was last summer I pitched this idea to Lucas, and I said, you know, for those who don't know, Lucas's Twitter handle is Lincoln Douglas. So if there's ever anyone to partner with on a book about Lincoln and Douglas, Lucas is the guy. So I reached out to Lucas and I said, you know, would you want to work on this with me? And he loved the idea. And so we started working and sort of pulling things together. Our original thought was probably about a 40,000-word book. We thought it would be so short that we could include Douglass's very famous What to the Slave is the 4th of July speech as an appendix. But last year, we began to start discovering new documents that no one has seen for a century and a half. And so we decided we needed to make this book comprehensive. It got up to over 100,000 words, and we included everything we could find that Frederick Douglass wrote or said about Lincoln.
Okay, now the historian in me is freaking out. How did you find documents that nobody else has seen for so long? Where were these?
Yeah, so this is one of the incredible things. You know, we live and research and write in an era where we have digital technology. So we couldn't have discovered these things 20 or 30 years ago. So we knew that Frederick Douglass corresponded with British abolitionists, and there are some letters that Douglass wrote to British abolitionists that were found in the previous decades that have been included in the various editions of Douglass's published papers. But I began to wonder if maybe there were more that were out there that we didn't know about. And so I started searching on different newspaper databases, and I found some letters that no one had seen before. And then I also found excerpts from others that were not fully available in digitized newspapers. So at one point last year, I actually purchased microfilm from London. It was the only way I could get it. got it sent to me in a digital format, was able to go through those and found even more letters. And then Lucas did searching on newspapers.com and other databases and found other versions of speeches of Douglas, that the speeches were known, but these versions or these statements were unknown. And so in the end, we found about a dozen things that will be totally new to historians.
Huh. Now, does this indicate that somebody needs to write a new book on Douglas? Do you think that there's enough out there that hasn't been? Ah, Lucas, are you currently working on anything?
I don't know about an entirely new book on Douglas, but one thing that we had been doing while we were writing this book is we were also composing an essay for the Smithsonian Magazine. And so we have made an exclusive contribution to them. That article should come out probably in the next week or two. And they, you know, as things are wont to go, the title of the book is ours, but the title of the article is the Smithsonian's, and they call the article The New Frederick Douglass. Now, we will not say that he is altogether new, but we do have a couple of, we would like to say, reveals in that article. And so it's in the writing of the book, or at least the composing of this anthology and writing the article, that we put together some of the things that make Douglas or will make Douglas new to readers. So the extant biographies that are out right now are still fine biographies, but it is clearly the case in most fundamentally with regards to Douglas's opinion of Andrew Johnson. I guess we can talk about that a little later, but his opinion of Andrew Johnson around the time of Lincoln's assassination is something entirely new that we do not believe anybody knows about or has seen, precisely because it was an opinion he shared with the Leeds Mercury by way of a letter to an abolitionist. In fact, he wrote to two different abolitionists in April of 65, both sharing his grief, of course, over a man whom he considered his friend, but he also shared with the British audience an opinion, in fact, hopes, believe it or not, hopes for President Johnson being a more effective Reconstruction president than even Abraham Lincoln. And so the newness of the Douglas that we reveal in the book and in this article that's coming out in a couple of weeks has a lot to do with the fact that as a political strategist, he was saying one thing to the American audience, and at a few key moments during the war, a different opinion he allowed to be aired, and he knew these were being released in the papers, a different opinion he shared with a British audience that was fervently interested in promoting Douglas and the abolition cause across the pond.
Wow. That raises several questions for me. First of all, for our audience who might not be as familiar with Douglas, can you tell us a little bit about why he would have a British audience? I mean, most of our listeners will probably know that Frederick Douglass was an African-American who escaped slavery in the South, made a life as a free man in the North. Why was he writing to people in England?
Yeah, a couple of reasons. The most proximate one was he imposed, as John likes to call it, self-exile to the United Kingdom between 1845 and 1847, which is the time when he first published his first of three autobiographies, the one everybody's familiar with, Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave, and then he adds, written by himself. He spoke the King's English so well, there were people who did not believe he used to be an enslaved man on American soil. There's just no way you could speak the English language as eloquently as he did.
Anyway, they thought a white person must have written it for him.
Yeah, exactly. And he has a white person who writes an introduction, his mentor, William Lloyd Garrison, among others. Well, anyway, because he publishes details about who he is and where he escaped from and how he got to ultimately New Bedford, Massachusetts, he decides in a few months he's got to leave the country because under the 1793 Fugitive Slave Act, he could be apprehended and returned to his legal master. So for 2 years, he's touring the United Kingdom, Ireland, Scotland, England. He's selling copies of his autobiography there and he's giving speeches. He's finally manumitted legally, 150 pounds sterling, I think, which is about $700 American, mostly raised by British abolition friends. And so that allows him to return safely to the United States in about March, April of 47. So that's the proximate cause. Why would he be riding people over there? But the fact of the matter was, as the decade rolls around, the 40s and 50s, not just Frederick Douglass, but abolitionists both sides of the Atlantic are sharing news from the home front, as it were. And I think it's something around 80 some odd letters to Douglass he publishes in his newspaper. And he published several newspapers under different names, the first one called the North Star. But what this was actually something that they just did as a matter of course to kind of inform people both sides of the Atlantic what's going on, not just politically, but culturally as well. It was kind of like a literary column in addition to political. And so the fact that he's sending letters overseas, and these letters contain private things as well, not just public and social commentary, but he knew that what he sent over there, they almost immediately, in other words, if not that day, the following day, they would be released to the Leeds Mercury and other British abolition newspapers because they wanted to hear from America, and not just abolitionists. Interestingly enough, they really wanted to listen to hear news from someone who escaped slavery and was, I mean, as it were, from the horse's mouth. And Frederick Douglass surely was the most famous black person in the world at that time. So that's why those letters are being shared.
And when Douglass is writing these letters and describing things about America to English audiences, do we feel as though he was being more honest, more blunt in his assessment of what was going on in America? Or was he spinning things for his international audience in order to achieve certain political goals? Is it possible for us to even know?
It may not be possible to know definitively, but I do think he was more candid with his British audience than he was with American audiences. It's interesting, when I first started to find these letters last summer, I remember calling Lucas and saying, like, listen to this, you won't believe this. And Lucas was incredulous. He doubted at first, you know, is this really real? And to be fair to Lucas, British readers also had their doubts. I found an op-ed where an editor in England wrote a story and said, you know, we realize that many of our readers don't think these letters are authentic, and here's why we think they're consistent with what we know Douglass writes. And what Lucas and I then did was we went to the Douglass papers at the Library of Congress, and we were able to find many of the receipts. So Douglass would send a letter to England, it would get published in the papers, and then one of these British abolitionists would write back and say, oh, I took your letter to the editor of the Leeds Mercury, and I took out the personal parts, and we published an extract of the public parts. And so that confirmed for us, you know, these letters are authentic. And they do show Douglass trying to shape British opinion, like Lucas said. You know, Douglass was focused on black equality being the outcome of the Civil War. So freedom first and equality immediately after. And everything that he says on the stump in America and in these letters to Great Britain is pushing for that goal. But in these letters, he does say things that he wouldn't have said in America. So, for instance, what Lucas talked about with the Andrew Johnson letters, you know, Douglass says that very publicly about it's terrible that Lincoln was assassinated, but Andrew Johnson might be a better president for black people in the post-war period.
Wow.
Douglass is also very candid about certain aspects of the Civil War in ways that he kind of hints at to American audiences, but I don't think is as clear. So in one letter, Douglass talks about how he doesn't want the war to end because he recognizes that rights are being won for black Americans in the South as long as Union soldiers are stationed in the Confederacy. But when the war ends and emancipation is no longer a military necessity and Union troops are withdrawn from the Southern states, what's next? There's no telling. I don't know if Douglass would have ever been that candid to an American audience. I mean, again, he hinted at this in some writings and speeches in America, but very bluntly talks about how he doesn't want the war to end. And he says that to a British audience. And again, that shows how laser focused Douglass was on we've got to win rights now while we still have the chance.
Yeah. What did equality mean to Douglass? You said he was pushing for freedom and then equality right after the war. Equality in terms of what? Equal voting rights? Equality in terms of access to public transportation? Was he pushing for something like the civil rights that we're familiar with in the 1960s? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, the easy answer is yes, yes, all of the above. But again, depending on the year, depending on the month, Douglass did push for things on a more prudential level than a categorical one. So, for example, in the 15th Amendment, which got him into trouble with the women's rights movement.
Right, yeah.
I mean, when it comes to women's rights, people should know that Douglass was as we would say today, an early adopter. He was always on board categorically. All rights for all men was a slogan of his. And so he was emphatically in favor of women having the same right as men to vote. However, in the 15th, when the 15th Amendment is ratified in 1870, and he gets in trouble, especially with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who says some very racially derogatory things about him, he says, look, sure, it would be great if white women, and especially since so many of them were literate women, right? He's talking to people who are arguably more literate than he is, more well-read than he is. Yes, they deserve the vote. But in 1860, in 1870, the vote for you is a good thing. The vote for black men is a matter of survival. In other words, if men don't get this, we are at the mercy of communities. You know, when it was a slave society, we were at the mercy of a legal master. Without the vote after abolition, they are at the mercy of the white community, which is no different, especially when they're living among ex-rebels, right? Former Confederates south of the Mason-Dixon line. And so there were times when he was more prudential. But for getting back to John's point, equality meant equality. He was a greater believer in the Declaration of Independence and all men are created equal than most Americans were, in the sense that he thought, shoot, if you do not give black people the vote, you are actually communicating to people that there is something different. No, I'll be more specific. There's something inferior about black people, that they don't deserve or can't handle the vote. And he says that cannot happen. He was very much attuned to how policies and institutions shape public opinion. And he said to deny black people the vote when universal suffrage, I put that in scare quotes, is the rule, it communicates the myth of white supremacy. And so if white people have the vote, or more specifically, if white males get the vote, there is absolutely no reason why black males, who are free in this country, and right, this was happening during the war with emancipation, after the war, when the 13th Amendment is ratified in December of 65, if they're free citizens of this country, you explain to me why we shouldn't have the vote. And so equality for him meant equality across the board, but it began with the vote. There were times, in fact, in speeches where he would say, just give black men the vote, and we will now be able to defend ourselves.
Yeah.
I think he even recognized that was an overstatement, but his point was, we cannot do without. There is no plan B for us. After the war, we have got to have the vote.
Yeah.
And along those lines, he would always be very precise that he was not calling for special treatment or different treatment, but equal treatment under the law.
Yeah. Well, a couple of times now you've mentioned that something new you've discovered is that he had potentially a favorable opinion of Andrew Johnson, at least at the start of Johnson's administration. This raises the question, what did Douglass think about Lincoln? And why did he think that Johnson could do a better job than Lincoln could with Reconstruction? So what does your book tell us about Douglass's view of Lincoln? Is there a single view that he has? Does his view change over time? What can we learn?
Yeah, so that's a very big question. And the short answer is Douglass's view changes over time. So Douglass first becomes familiar with Abraham Lincoln in 1858 when Lincoln is debating Stephen Douglass for the U.S. Senate seat in Illinois. And Douglass is impressed by Lincoln in 1858 by the House Divided address. And in fact, in his newspaper, Douglass quotes it at length and favorably quotes it. When Lincoln becomes president, though, Douglas begins to have doubts about Lincoln, even before Lincoln becomes president. So, you know, Douglas had a view of the Constitution that if you interpreted it correctly, you would get to anti-slavery outcomes. And for Douglas, the reason we had slavery in the nation was because you had these pro-South, pro-slavery presidents who were misunderstanding and misconstruing the U.S. Constitution. So Douglas's hope is that when an anti-slavery person becomes president, he will take action to get rid of slavery. Well, Lincoln is anti-slavery, but Lincoln doesn't interpret the Constitution the same way. Lincoln sees the Constitution as a compromise that has some pro-slavery and some anti-slavery aspects to it. But ultimately, Lincoln believes that the Constitution allows the states to protect and regulate slavery for themselves if they want to, and that the president can't just abolish slavery where it exists. And Lincoln also believes that the Fugitive Slave Clause of the Constitution is there to protect the right of slaveholders to recapture fugitive slaves, whereas Douglas says, oh, that doesn't mention slavery. Slaves don't owe service or labor to anyone. That's about indentured servants. And I'm not persuaded by Douglas's argument on that one, and Lincoln certainly wasn't either. So when Lincoln comes into the presidency and says that he's not going to touch slavery where it exists and that he will enforce the Fugitive Slave Law, although he hopes it will be amended, Douglas looks at that and says the South has no reason to secede. He calls Lincoln the South's greatest slave hound and abolitionism's worst enemy.
Wow.
And so for the first year and a half of the war, Douglas is highly critical of Lincoln for not pushing the issue of black freedom in a way that Douglas wanted him to. Over the course of the war, though, they have three meetings, and those meetings begin to give Douglas a sense of the political realities and constraints that Lincoln was facing. They also give Douglas a sense of the fact that Lincoln's heart was fully in black freedom, even if Lincoln couldn't move as quickly as Douglas wanted him to. And I think in the years after the war, Douglas came to appreciate that Lincoln's approach had actually been the right one, that if Lincoln had acted too quickly, too early in the war, it would have been politically, it would have destroyed the Union cause, because you would have had the border states join the Confederacy and many Northern soldiers deserting, and the Union would not have won and the slaves wouldn't have become free. So wow. I think in hindsight, Douglas looked back at Lincoln and recognized that Lincoln's approach had been, as a statesman, had been the right one. Now, one other piece of the question that you raised is, like, how could he look at Andrew Johnson and think this is the guy who's going to be our Moses? And the reason is because Andrew Johnson said, I will be your Moses. So Andrew Johnson,
he's a Tennessean. He's kind of a Democrat who stays loyal to the Union. So Lincoln appoints him as or accepts him as a vice president. But Johnson is pro-slavery in his heart, I think it would be fair to say, or at least anti-black in his heart, right?
Very, very much so anti-black. So okay. Johnson was the military governor of Tennessee in 1864 when he was also the Republican or Union Party nominee for vice president. And Tennessee had been exempted from the Emancipation Proclamation. So Johnson actually issued a proclamation ending slavery in Tennessee. And in October of 1864, Johnson gives a speech to a black audience in Nashville. And he has a give and take with the audience. And in that give and take, he says, I will indeed be your Moses. So it was actually not unreasonable for Frederick Douglass to think that Andrew Johnson would be favorable towards black people and unfavorable towards the planter class, because Johnson had given every indication that that would be the case. He had said treason must be made odious. And so Douglass and other radicals expected Johnson to be a radical in the White House. And of course, they would be sorely disappointed.
Before we continue with our conversation, I think it's important to take a moment and tell you about our undergraduate honors program in the liberal arts here at Ashland University.
Hi, I'm Rich Police, Associate Director of Student Programs at the Ashbrook Center. The Ashbrook Scholar Program is an honors program located at Ashland University for undergraduate students with an interest in politics, history, and economics. Modeled after a classical liberal education, you will read the great texts, not textbooks. Your classes will be conversations, not lectures. conversations with other students, with your professors, and with great thinkers and statesmen from throughout human history. If you or a young person you know are passionate about life's important questions, if you want an education that emphasizes discovery, if you value liberal education and the principles of freedom it upholds, then this is the place for you. To learn more, visit us online at ashbrookscholar.org.
That's so interesting. Okay. Now, the one other question that I had, though, is what did Douglass think that Lincoln was going to do? If Lincoln had lived, what would Lincoln have done during Reconstruction in, according to Frederick Douglass's estimation of him?
Yeah. And so I'm going to read just a quick blurb from, it's not a blurb, but a quotation from one of the letters that he shares with a longtime collaborator and supporter of his named Julia Griffiths, and her married name is Julia Griffiths Cross. He writes to her days after Lincoln is assassinated. So he writes to her on April 20th, and then an excerpt from, a pretty lengthy excerpt from the letter gets published in the Leeds Mercury of England in May of 65. And so this is what he says about Lincoln. He says, "I think the first great work of Mr. Lincoln was done. By his excellent qualities, his wonderful moderation, his remarkable caution, and his extreme amiability." So remember those personal qualities right now, okay? "He," Lincoln, "held the country together in the presence of this tremendous rebellion better than any other man perhaps could have done." So those personal qualities, he thought, were effective for Lincoln to hold the morale and support of the North and the West against the Southern rebellion. But he thought those very qualities would undermine what would be needed in the rebellious territories and states after the war. In other words, in a way, he thought Lincoln would be too soft, too weak towards ex-rebels. And so this is what he says one paragraph later in the same letter. "Mr. Johnson is in many respects better qualified for the work to come than was Mr. Lincoln." And he goes on to say, "Unlike Mr. Lincoln, he has lived all his life in a slave state, better understands than Mr. Lincoln did the necessity of putting down not only slavery, but the slave power." And then I'm going to skip just a few lines. This is the last quote. "I hope much of him, Johnson. I hope he will see to it that the Negro is made every way equal before the laws of the South. Without the ballot, freedom for the Negro in the slave states will be but little better than a name." And so he thinks what we have in Johnson is someone who knows his neighbors, shall we say. Johnson knows the slaveholding class, and he hates them. He envies them. He doesn't care a lick about black people. That's for sure. That never changes. And Douglass, unfortunately, within a few months, finds that out, and especially after an interview with Johnson in February of 66 that goes disastrously. Douglass knows this guy is no friend of the black man. But in that April and May period, he has high hopes for Johnson precisely because Johnson makes it look like he's going to be the best friend for black people in the South, just like he claimed he was going to be their Moses in Tennessee in October of 64. And so he thinks Johnson is going to basically rule the South somehow, well, with an iron hand. He says they must not only be punished, but their social power must be destroyed. And Johnson sticks to that script. They try to get more specifics out of him, and he is super savvy. And that is one thing I don't think people appreciate as much about Johnson today, because we obviously figure out what, we've learned what a disaster he was as a Reconstruction president. But rhetorically speaking, he was very clever in wrapping himself with the mantle of Lincoln and using, sticking to the script about what has to happen in terms of punishing the South, which Douglass saw, took more seriously and expected more of Johnson than he did, given what he learned about Lincoln. What would most likely have been the case is that Lincoln would have respected the authority that the states had to have once the war was over. Lincoln did not want to rule them from on high, as it were. That said, the realities on the ground might have led Lincoln to continue to occupy the South as much as possible with the Union Army until he had governments sufficiently loyal to the Union. And we know for a fact that that was he was doing all he could informally and formally to make that a reality.
Now, we know that in his final public address, rather an informal address, Lincoln did support the vote for certain qualified Black men. Was Douglas aware of Lincoln's potential support for Black voting?
Yeah, Douglas was aware of that speech. The speech was published in newspapers. And in fact, before that speech, about a year before, Lincoln had written a letter to the governor of Louisiana calling for the right to vote for Black men who were either educated or served in arms. And that letter became public after Lincoln's assassination, and Douglas became aware of that as well. And it's interesting because with these public statements by Lincoln calling for the right to vote for these two classes of Black men, some people pointed to that and said, you know, there's no qualifications for white men to vote. We have universal white manhood suffrage. Why shouldn't we have universal Black manhood suffrage? And it bothered them that Lincoln didn't call for universal Black manhood suffrage. But it didn't bother Douglas. Douglas said that Lincoln learned, you know, Douglas admired the fact that Lincoln had risen out of poverty and that Lincoln had once been poor like Douglas, although obviously very different circumstances, but that they had both risen out of poverty and sort of learned what Douglas said Lincoln had learned his statesmanship by splitting rails. And what Douglas meant by that, and he even said this explicitly, when you split rails, you took the thin edge of a wedge and you put it on the log and you would begin to strike it. And eventually, as you strike it, the thin edge gets in and then the thick edge gets in. And that is what ultimately splits the log. And Douglas likened that experience of Lincoln's as a young man to what Lincoln was doing in pushing for limited Black manhood suffrage. Douglas said that Lincoln didn't offend sensibilities needlessly, meaning Lincoln knew there would be massive opposition to Black men voting. But it's hard to make the case that men who serve their country don't deserve the right to vote. And so what Douglas saw was that by saying, you know, Black veterans should be allowed to vote, that was getting the thin edge of the wedge in. And eventually, Douglas said, the thick edge will get in, meaning all Black men will get the right to vote. And so, yes, Douglas was aware of Lincoln's statement and used it to try to fight for the right to vote.
Wow. So we've learned some new things about Frederick Douglass already as a result of what you all are telling us here. Are there other things that you discovered that people will learn from reading your book that are perhaps going to be new information about Douglass or change our perceptions of him in some ways?
There's a lot. And, you know, we're excited for the book to get out there. We're hoping it will be used in high school and college classrooms because we want people to be able to engage with Douglass's ideas and Douglass's words. Mm-hmm. And students and faculty alike will find new commentary from Douglass on really important aspects of Lincoln's presidency. We found some letters where Douglass talks about the Emancipation Proclamation and the process by which it eventually came about. We found an incredible letter from September of 1864 where Douglass offers some new perspective on his second meeting with Lincoln that I've written extensively about in A House Built by Slaves. And man, I wish I'd had this letter 5 years ago when I was writing that book. And that also offers new perspective on Douglass's view of the election of 1864. I mean, there are some things that we've known about Douglass with that election through writings and speeches that he gave. But in one of these letters to a British correspondent, Douglass makes an admission where he says, I'm being more practical now than I used to be. I mean, that is an extraordinary line from Frederick Douglass. And it was Douglass saying, you know, I wish John C. Fremont could be the guy. But he says, and I'm paraphrasing here, he says, essentially, Fremont is a man without a party. And if you don't have a party, you don't win votes. And, you know, that's not the radical Douglass. That's a Douglass who is seeing, okay, Lincoln is the guy who's going to have to see this through, and he may not do everything I want him to, but he's the guy who can win.
That's amazing. My next question was going to be, If we were to play a counterfactual and imagine that Douglas was the president, how would things have turned out differently? But it seems that Douglas himself imagined that situation and predicted that actually things would have turned out worse had a more idealistic person held the reins of power.
Yeah, I think the most telling quotation comes years later in his great eulogy to Lincoln in April of 1876 with the dedication of the Freedmen's Memorial in Washington, D.C., where Douglas gives this remarkable speech from the perspective of an abolitionist. And he says, from the true abolition grounds, Lincoln was slow, tardy, cold, and indifferent, but viewed from the grounds of a statesman. And he says, Lincoln was bound as a statesman to view the situation in a more capacious way. He judges at this point that Lincoln was swift, zealous, radical, and what's the
determined.
Last one? Determined. There it is. In that wonderful paragraph, he admits that if Lincoln had turned the war into an abolition war the way Douglas wanted, we would not have gotten abolition or the preservation of the Union. And so in an oblique way, he concedes he was wrong. And Frederick Douglass isn't the kind of guy who likes to admit that he's wrong. So it's a really amazing speech.
That is. Yeah, I always, when I'm thinking about statesmanship and prudence in leadership, I always come back to, but what if I was the slave? Or what if I had family and friends who were still in slavery? I wouldn't care about prudence and politics and elections. I would just want my family to be rescued as quickly as possible. And of course, Douglas is in that position of being himself an escapee from slavery. So it's fascinating to hear about his emotional and intellectual journey from being so frustrated with the slowness of Lincoln to eventually being able to appreciate that Lincoln was able to accomplish the goal of emancipation by being slow.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that Douglas really appreciated was, to borrow from him, you need law and a sword, in a sense. Like, you need enslaved people who have the drive to run away and become
free.
But you
why do you need them?
Sorry?
Why do you need them? Why do you need enslaved people
their initiative
to run away?
Often, as Ira Berlin has shown, sort of presses the issue. So their initiative presses the issue where I live in Hampton Roads, Virginia, with General Butler. It presses the issue in other theaters of the war, leads to the contraband policy, and forces the issue to always be on the table. And so Douglas totally recognizes that as being important. And for him, same thing. He had, as you pointed out earlier, he had run away, but Douglas also recognized the importance of law, that you need a power to enforce freedom and to protect it. So why does he flee to London or to England? Because he could be recaptured. He, as Lucas often says, he is at that point in his life an outlaw. He's outside of the law and could be recaptured. So he needs to be he needs a legal piece of paper that declares him free. And so Douglas, while he wants people to become free as soon as possible, he also recognizes that you need something like the Emancipation Proclamation, and you need something like an army enforcing it to make sure that freedom becomes real and becomes permanent. And, you know, he gave a wonderful speech that Lucas and I wrote about in the Wall Street Journal for the for Juneteenth this year, where Douglas likens the Emancipation Proclamation to the Declaration of Independence. And you had a lot of people criticizing the proclamation then, as they do now, saying, oh, well, the proclamation didn't free anyone when Lincoln signed it. What good is it? And Douglas responds by saying, well, yes, but the Declaration of Independence didn't free anyone on July 4th, 1776 either. It took a war to sort out. It took a war to make real. And so Douglas recognized these things take time, and they require law, and they require governmental authority to make it a reality. And so I think his understanding was a really deep and rich one that can inform for modern readers how to really understand what was taking place during the war.
Okay. Now, one final question for me. After Douglas was disappointed by Andrew Johnson, do you have any evidence that he reevaluated his opinion of Lincoln and Lincoln's Reconstruction once he realized that perhaps he shouldn't have placed so much hope in Andrew Johnson after all?
Well, all that comes to my mind, well, a number of things come to my mind, but the one thing that readily comes to my mind is he has this, it's well known that Johnson had called himself the Moses of Black Americans. And of course, people threw that back in his face the year that follows him, you know, declaring amnesty to, you know, hundreds and thousands of ex-Confederates, of speeding the readmission of slave states into the Union, where it's, you know, only the whites could vote for congressmen at that point. And so he looks way more of a friend to those who tried to destroy the Union than to Black people who tried to preserve it. And so later, Douglas says that at least Lincoln did not, quote, begin as a Moses and end as a Pharaoh. And I love his turn of phrase there. So that was one thing. And he just, you know, once it was clear to Douglas, and it only took a few months, but once it was clear to Douglas that Johnson really has dashed the hopes of any Black American for having an improvement in their lives in the way of civil and political rights. Mm-hmm. He is all reverence for Lincoln. In one speech he gives after the disastrous interview with Johnson in February of 66, he says, "He who says President Johnson is following in the footsteps of his predecessor casts foul dishonor on the name of Abraham Lincoln." And in a way, Lincoln, you know, what we like to say, lives rent-free in Frederick Douglass's head pretty much for the rest of his life. We have speeches that he gives, is it over a dozen, John, that as late as 1894, a year before Douglass dies, as late as 1894, Douglass is still giving eulogies and speeches in honor of Abraham Lincoln. And he's using the name and reputation of Lincoln on behalf of the greatest, you know, the highest and noblest ideals of the American regime, you know, equality, liberty, rights, and government by consent of the governed. In other words, the vote, all of these things Douglass now argues by donning the mantle or waving the banner of Abraham Lincoln.
Wow. The book is called Measuring the Man, The Writings of Frederick Douglass on Abraham Lincoln, and it comes out on October the 1st. Is there anything else that we should know or that you'd like our audience to know about this book?
You know, we struggled with the title. Since you mentioned the title, I want to just point this out. Lucas and I really struggled with the title because Douglass has such a complex view of Lincoln and a view that evolves and changes over time that we didn't want to do something like emphatically the Black man's president or preeminently the white man's president, you know, something that showed either praise or that showed condemnation, because Douglass has both for Lincoln at different points.
Yeah.
And the one thing that stuck out to us was that Douglass in multiple writings talks about Black people taking the measure of Abraham Lincoln. Mm. And one day it just came to us, measuring the man, that this
I'm
book
being
is,
charitable. It came to him.
It came to me, fair. But this idea that this book is one great leader measuring another and get sort of the breadth and the depth of his views of Lincoln. So we both love the title and we're glad the press went with it.
As soon as John emailed or texted, probably texted, and we were texting like crazy. As soon as he texted me that, I said, boom, that's it. Nailed it. Don't stop. Tell them we will not publish it without this title.
Naming a book is harder than people might imagine at first.
Yeah, well, we definitely wanted, as he said, we wanted a quotation from him, but we didn't want one that people go, oh, yeah, that's just a hagiography. It's just, Douglass loving Lincoln. And we're like, no, most of this book is not loving Lincoln. It's really critical, and it's very nuanced as well. And so how do you get nuance into a pithy quote? Oh, my goodness, he actually said it more than once, that he's measuring the man. He's weighing, sifting, considering. And if you will, this is what the reader will be equipped to do. They can look through Douglass's eyes and go, oh, I can see why he wanted that, expected that of Lincoln. I can see why he was critical about that. But, oh, well, we also know how things turned out and Douglass changes his mind. And so, yeah, I mean, John just nailed it when he found that quote. And I'm like, yes, that's what we're running with.
That's fantastic. And it's maybe an inspirational quote for for your readers that not only did Douglass need to measure Lincoln, and we can measure Lincoln, but also that we should be measuring all of our leaders rather than throwing them on the dust pile of history or putting them on pedestals. It's important to carefully evaluate, and perhaps our opinions will change over time the way that Douglass's did.
Yeah, I think that's well put, especially because, as John laid out earlier, with Douglass, you don't just get what's the traditional Douglass, which is mostly true, which is he's a radical abolitionist. He has every reason to be. He was born into slavery. As I tell it to my students, Douglass had every reason to hate America, but then changed his mind about the country that didn't love him, and for the longest time, he didn't love it. He came to love America. So how do we love America? What is it that we see in our governors, our rulers, that both reflects principle, right, in categorical positions being held, but also applying prudence? What can we see them doing that's practical, that's sensible in light of what you could garner a majority on behalf of justice? That's the challenge of statesmanship. And we see someone wrestling in real time in our book with that very question.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and telling us about this. I can't wait to read it myself. Measuring the Man, the Writings of Frederick Douglass on Abraham Lincoln. John and Lucas, thanks again.
Thanks to Ashbrook Center.
All right.
Thank you.
And thank you to our audience. We'll see you next time on The American Idea.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.